This is Sciographies, an introduction to the people who make science happen. I'm your host, David Barkley. I'm an oceanographer with the Faculty of Science here at Dalhousie University. And on Sciographies, I interview different types of scientists about what shaped their interests, their career path, and how they get their research ideas. Thanks for joining us. In this episode, we talk to Dr. Sophia Stone, a professor in the Department of Biology. Dr. Stone was born in Jamaica and immigrated to Ontario when she was just 15 years old. Now, she's a molecular biologist with a specialty in plant science. Her research explores the fundamental principles that explain how plants respond to their environments and cope with big changes. It's an area of research that's especially important today as challenges with global food security become increasingly urgent in the face of climate change and a growing population. Dr. Stone is also passionate about increasing diversity in STEM fields. I do like to start at the very beginning.
Okay.
So I guess, where were you born? Where did you grow up, more importantly?
Yeah. Okay. So I was actually born in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Jamaican. I came here when I was 15.
Okay.
And so I came here and I went straight into high school.
Yeah.
I've gone to religious schools most of my life. So I went to a Catholic high school in Ontario.
Okay.
And before that, my high school in Jamaica was actually run by nuns. And I wanted to become a nun for some
Obviously.
Time.
It makes perfect sense. Yeah.
When I came to Canada, that kind of went out the window. So then I went into science.
Okay. Well, let's talk nuts and bolts. So are most of the schools in Jamaica religious?
No, it's just the one that I went
to.
And it was a legacy school for me because all my aunts went there.
Nice.
And I was expected to go there. So I did.
Yeah.
There was no if, ands, or but. And back home, you had to take an exam to go to high school. You didn't just go to high school.
Mm-hmm.
And to get into this particular high school, you had to get a certain percentage on the test. So it was the scariest time in your
sure.
life if you're going to get into high school and which one, because they tell you which one to go to based on your grade.
Right.
But the one thing that still sticks in my mind is that they actually published the results in the newspaper.
Ah, well, with names.
With names.
Oh, my.
And the school that you're going to go to.
Oh, my. this is a nightmare.
And then the morning of, my mother, my grandmother, me, got up, went to the newsstand, got the paper, tears running down my eye. And then she looked in the paper and she saw that I was going to the right school. She's like, okay, we can go home.
So excellence is just an expectation.
It was
your
an
family.
Expectation.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, so it is.
Fair enough,
yeah.
Fair enough. And obviously you wanted to become a nun, so you enjoyed the experience.
I enjoyed my experience in the high school,
mm-hmm.
yes. And I'm the kind of person who tend to look for mentors and things.
Mm-hmm.
And the principal, Sister Joan Clare, she was a great mentor, and she really looked out for us. Because we're an all-girls school, actually,
mm-hmm.
and she really looked out for us. So I looked up to her, and you know, I kind of wanted to follow what she was doing. But then when I came to Canada, I had to find a new route,
right.
a new way to go.
Were there any positions of prestige? Were you like a hall monitor, or were you like top girl?
You
I know there's
really
like these.
Know about these
I know there's some stuff. What is it
yes,
called?
Yes, I was a prefect.
The prefect. It's so close to perfect, isn't it? It's just you were a prefect. So what does that mean? You get like you were in charge.
I was in charge, and not only did I get to help set the rules, I get to enforce the rules, and I could punish. I could punish other students, and they had to do what I taught them.
So, did you ever abuse your power as the prefect? It's okay. The statute of limitations has passed. Yeah.
No, I didn't, because I knew what it was like to not be a prefect.
Yeah.
I was more proud of the fact that I got it, because you stood out because you got a special tie
okay.
to wear.
And in that decision-making process, were you involved in deciding to come to Canada or not, or was it your
no.
parents told you?
No. You just woke up one day and you're going to Canada, and that's it. And you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you understand the story in retrospect now, why they decided to?
Yes. Yeah. I totally understand why my parents did that. Because my mother's mantra in life was her children were supposed to do better than her
at
all times and everything. So that fit in with her mantra of coming to another country so that we could do better
okay.
than she did and mm-hmm. accomplish more than she did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you said Ontario, so what, whereabouts in the province
did you Mississauga. Actually, we went to Brampton first.
Okay.
And then we moved to Mississauga after that, and then my family's still in Mississauga right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how did the culture shock hit you? All new people, no friends right away. And
yeah, that was hard. I kind of turned into myself a little bit at that point. My sister was, I am, what, 8 years older than my sister?
Okay.
So what I did was I just took on more roles at home. So I just stayed busy. Like, I was the de facto babysitter.
Right.
Help mom out, do things. So going back into the Catholic school system there kind of gave me a familiar surroundings.
Right.
Because you would do the same things, right? You go to mass, you have to do like your volunteer work and all of that stuff. So it gave me that, you know, comfort of, okay, this is something I know and understand.
Yeah.
But choosing my science classes and going into my science classes again, it was, you know, something that I knew.
Right.
And I was excited about. So that helped also. Yeah.
So going back, you were always science focused as a student, do you think?
In Jamaica, you actually streamed pretty early.
Okay.
You have to choose your subject where you wanted to go.
Yeah.
And my mother was, she was a secretary, and she was like, you're not going to do that. So there's no business, there's no, nothing secretarial or anything for you. So my choice was, okay, let me try science.
Okay. And in, so at your school, so was it mostly just white kids or was there people from all around? No,
it was, especially when I went to science classes. I was probably most of the time the only black person in the class. And I dealt with that straight through till university.
Yeah. Did that have a big impact on, do you think, your becoming yourself?
Yes. It made me want to work harder because I couldn't fail. So
the burden of being the representational person.
Yes. You become the de facto representation. So you behaved well all the time and you work hard all the time and you get the A all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So you had to do grade 12, grade 13, and then you were graduating. You obviously had great grades and you were thinking about university.
Right.
What were you thinking at the time? What was your logic and choice there?
I wanted to stay close to home.
Yeah.
And that was my one criteria. I went to York University.
Okay.
Yeah.
And obviously you're on a science track.
Yeah.
You've already ruled out physics. It must have not taken you too long to decide on your specialty, on what you want to do.
So I went into neurobiology, actually.
Okay, neurobiology, yeah.
I did, like, animal physiology and development and my neurobiology courses. I did my honors thesis in insect neurophysiology at York. So,
listeners can't see, but I'm nodding my head like I understand. Neuro, I need to parse the word. Bio, neuro, oh, sorry.
Insect.
Insects,
so I
worked
with locusts for my honors thesis.
And you were looking at their neurology as well as their physiology.
Right, so neurophysiology.
Yes.
So, I did my honors thesis with Barry Loughton. He was great.
Yeah.
He was a great professor.
Yeah. Okay, for us lay people, you have a locust.
Right. So we were interested in like octopamine and what it does to fat bodies in the locusts. So you would get the locusts, do weird stuff to them.
We want to hear about the weird stuff is what I'm trying to get at here.
Oh, so Barry had a room, this huge room, with cages and cages of locusts. And it was dim because it couldn't have too much light. So you'd walk into this room. There's no windows because it's just wall of cages of locusts. But you could only work with the male.
Okay.
Right? And the way you tell a male from a female locust is by its rear end. So its abdomen. So you have to pick it up. And then it's rounded or pointy.
Yeah.
So you have to climb on these ladders, stick your hand into the cage, and then the locust swarms and grab one. And then turn it over and look at its bum and say, okay, male or female? So picture an undergrad stepping into a barely lit room and locusts swarming around in cages. And then you have to like fetch maybe like 20 of them.
This is, and then you're doing physiological experiments.
Yeah, so we would apply, so it is it was a pharmacological-based study. So we apply various chemicals to them and then collect fluids and tissue and then do measurements after that, looking at, you know, like fatty acids and stuff like that. So
sounds like you had another great mentor.
Yes. Yeah. He was one of those old school scientists who didn't use like fancy equipment or anything to do stuff. He was, you know, so like he didn't even have like those mechanical pipettes. It was like, you know, those long glass tubes with the hole that you'd have to like suck up with your mouth.
Did you ever suck up any locusts, fatty acids?
Or fluids up in there? No. You learn pretty quickly how to do it properly.
Sorry, I had to ask it. Where were we? We're actually talking about your mentor. And was he giving you advice, career advice? Were you already in the fast track for graduate school?
After undergrad, I kind of hit a phase where I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was doing everything I was supposed to do.
Yeah.
And then, because in undergrad, you just keep going. It's class after class after class, right? But then at the end, you have to actually have to make a decision about your life. So I thought about dental school. I got the books for the DAT. I thought about med school. So I got the books for the MCAT. I thought about law school, patent law specifically. So I got the application just like for Einstein. Law school. And then Barry said to me, Daphne is looking for grad students. You know, I think, you know, she'd be great for you to work with. And I was like, more lab work. I really don't
Obviously, after the locust, you're not thinking.
But the thing is, she was a plant biologist.
Okay, so this is someone at York.
And she was a plant biologist, but I did all animal neurobiology.
Right.
And my apprehension was, do I need to switch? But I was just in my mother's basement languishing, wondering what to do. And then I said, you know what? It won't hurt. And I spoke to some other people who worked in her lab. And the department at the time, and they said, she's great, go talk to her. Everyone says, just go talk to her. And she turned out to be an absolutely amazing mentor. And so I did my PhD with her, and I fell in love with plant science because of the work that she did and how she trained you to be a scientist. So she didn't actually have me just doing work. She actually trained me to be a good scientist.
Okay, so what did that entail? I need to know this. As a supervisor.
Well, for one thing, you couldn't just do the bare minimum where she was concerned. You had to come, you know, prepared. You had to understand the question from all angle, and you had to do your research kind of thing. And she expected it from you, and she wanted it from you, and she told you when, you know, you're not meeting that mark.
How?
Right? Like, the one thing I remember is I had done this Western blot. And I got the antibody to work, and I was so pumped because it was like first time I did it. Yes, it's right. And I went to her and I showed it to her, saying, "Oh my God, look, I got results." And I was telling her what the samples were, and she says, "Where are your controls?" And I was like, "Oh, I was just trying to see if I could get it to work." And then I got a long spiel. About the importance of controls and every experiment counts, and I never ever did that again.
Thoroughness. So you stayed at York for grad school.
Yeah.
Okay. In retrospect, part of your decision, you had all good options laid out. You were maybe dentist, doctor, lawyer.
Right.
All big money options. Let's face it. You're going to be taking care of your family. No problem. We get any one of those. Graduate school. It's not necessarily going to work out to the big money option.
No.
And I feel like, you know, you were a very obedient person, right? I mean, in a good way. Yeah. You were respectful of your mentors and your mom. And so did deciding to go to grad school, did that feel like a bit of a rebellious option?
Not really, because when I did tell my mother that I was going to do this, she was okay with it. She was supportive of it. I lived at home the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was good.
Yes.
Dinner and laundry was done, right?
Oh. Yeah.
Mom, you were more than that.
Yes, yeah. Dinner laundry, emotional support. All sorts of things. Unbelievable.
You know, when I was studying for my first exam, and I moved into my aunt's house, into her basement, because she lived alone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would, you know, paste things on the wall, like all my pathways and stuff. I put them up on the wall, and I just, like, walk in front of them and study. You know, my mom would just appear with food or just come and, you know, she would take my clothes, and I didn't even realize she took my clothes and brought back fresh clothes. So, you know, I lived in that basement for, like, almost 2 months. Right? And, you know, I'll be writing my thesis late at night, and, you know, coffee would just appear next to your computer kind of thing. So she was very helpful, very supportive.
Yeah.
I couldn't have done it without.
Now you're thinking, now you're trying to make the decision, the post PhD decision. Now did the postdoc fall on your lap, or what was your strategy there?
So I took the usual route, you know, spam emailing everybody that you're interested in working with to find, you know, a place to go.
Yeah.
But Daphne said that I should go to one last conference and see who's there and see if you can make some connections that way.
Yeah.
And I went to seminar, and I saw Judy Callis give a talk. And when she's done talking, I'm like, I want to work with her. So then I accosted her in the hallway outside, and I wouldn't leave her alone until she agreed to that I could, you know, come and talk to her about a position.
Sure.
So then she said, okay, why don't you come out for a visit? You know, she took me to her house. We met her family. I met her entire lab. This is at University of California, Davis, right? And I had an amazing time there. The lab people were great. And so I did go to different places to interview for
postdoc. Okay, so you looked at a few options.
I did.
Yeah. And
she was actually the only professor who came to the airport and picked me up personally.
For on your tour, I do that. I do that.
I do it too because of the feeling I had when she picked me up. I pick up my students when they come here.
Yeah.
Even if they're coming from Ontario, I go pick them up at the airport. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good thing to do. So, I mean, so Davis is a mecca of plant science.
Yes.
Right? They've done just a massive amount of work that's impacted society in that place. It's crazy.
So that was one of the other reasons I went there, because I realized that I could do great plant science and interact with great plant scientists if I go there.
Yeah.
Right?
But, so that sounds like a great group you were
parachuted
into, but here's my real question. First time not living at home.
Yes. Oh, that was an experience.
Pretty advanced in age relative to the norm.
Yes.
How did it go?
There's a lot of calls home.
What's I don't want to say most embarrassing, but it's going to ultimately be that. What's the simplest thing you had to call home for?
The thing I called home for, I wanted to get one of those things to strain spaghetti in. So I went to the store and I didn't know what it was, and I had to call my mother long distance and say, Mom, what's that thing you strained the spaghetti in? She told me, you mean a colander? I'm like, yeah, that's it.
That's not so bad. No. That's not so bad. Could be worse. Yeah. And so you were Davis for three years.
There was a push to get the Arabidopsis genome sequenced. So after it was sequenced and that genome initiative was over, then there was a push to characterize each gene. Mm-hmm. So to figure out what proteins do each gene encode for.
Right.
So there was a whole bunch of labs involved in that, and Judy's lab was a part of this. So her lab was involved in characterizing genes that encode for proteins involved in a pathway, a specific pathway.
Sure.
And this is the ubiquitin proteasome system.
Mm-hmm.
So,
hang on a second, okay? The ubiquitin, does that mean it's everywhere?
That's it. It's ubiquitous.
Yeah.
So the person who found the gene first
says
it was ubiquitously expressed, meaning it was expressed in every cell.
Yeah.
Every eukaryotic cell expresses this protein.
Okay.
Hence the name ubiquitin.
I see.
Right? And because it's expressed in every eukaryotic cell, the pathway is conserved and used by all eukaryotes. So the same enzymes and the same mechanism and the mechanics of the pathway in plants is the same in humans and yeast. Amazing. Right?
So you wanted to go back home after 3 years. And what was your next step?
Get a job in academia.
Okay.
Yeah.
And was there any other option on the table, really? Is there a path from cell biology to industry?
I did go to industry.
You did?
It's not on my CV, though.
Now we're getting
maybe
to good
stuff.
Maybe I shouldn't
talk about it because I've never put it anywhere. I only worked there for 6 months, and I worked there while I was interviewing at places because I just wanted to come back to Canada. Sure. So when I was interviewing, they offered me the job. And it was a plant. It was a plant biology company.
Yeah.
So I went there and still went for interviews. And they.
It's like, why did you wear a suit to work today?
why do you need today off again? So, I got offers and I decided to come to Dell. So I only spent maybe 6 months there, and then I came to Dell.
You had a pretty good idea of what your research program was going to look like right from the get-go?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. I knew I wanted to keep working on the ubiquitin proteasome system.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a matter of where and what process I was going to study. I first did early plant development, so when you go from a seed to a seedling, that transition, because you have to go from one developmental program to the next. Mm-hmm. You have to shut down certain genes, turn on certain genes, and then, you know, you initiate the developmental pathway. So I was interested in, you know, the process that was involved in that, right? And then the role of the ubiquitin proteasome system in that stage of development. And then I looked at root development. So when the plant grows, it produces that primary root that grows down, right? But then it produces lateral roots that goes out. Those roots are, you know, like searching for water, nutrient uptake, all of that. So the root architecture is important.
Yeah.
So we started looking at the ubiquitin proteasome system that too.
So for a plant cell biologist, you're talking a lot about the big picture.
Yeah.
Yeah. And was that something that you looked at, you know, already had considered in your research, or was that something that you grew when you started here?
I think I grew into it a little bit because I had the genes that I wanted to work on, right? And then sometimes when you work on the genes, they lead you where you expect them to take you. But other times they take you into places that you don't know.
And you've got into issues of food security and these big societal pictures, not so much in your research, but the application of your research.
Yes, because that's the big question we're trying to answer.
Right.
How we're going to feed the exploding population, especially with climate change. So not only do we have to have, we have a population that's growing, but we have climate change that's, you know, making it harder to produce the types of yields that we would expect to produce to feed that population, right?
Yeah.
So soil is eroding, right? You know, the weather is now extremes. You go and have more droughts or you have more flooding kind of thing. So how do you come up with solutions to this challenge, right? The first thing you have to do is to understand how it is that a plant respond to its environment. How does it interact with its environment? And like, how does it develop? So how does it develop normally? And how does it develop when it's stressed or growth conditions aren't optimal? And to understand that, you have to get into the genetics and the molecular biology behind it. And then once you understand that, you can then say, how do we use this knowledge to modify or to tweak or to improve the plant so that we can, say, have a plant that is better adapted at, you know, fighting off a pathogen so that it can, and then still produce yield.
Right.
It can better adapt to more extended drought conditions or soil that's not so great.
Yes.
Right. And still produce yield to feed the population.
Right.
Right. So the research that I do brings this knowledge forward for them to use to then do these things.
Very interesting. Okay. It's good to be, it's great that you're at the heart of the problem. You know, you really are at the heart of the problem. Yeah. So you had great mentors who were big champions of women in science.
Yeah. Yes. My, both my grad supervisor Daphne and my postdoc supervisor, Judy.
But you also picked up this attribute yourself. This is something you're pretty active in.
Yes, I am pretty active in here. But it's not only from them. I did learn from them. But at the same time, being Black and in science, you tend to have a natural want to make sure that you help to promote the next person, right? So when I first came here, that's the first thing I looked for. And I found the MSF Legacy Academy, the stuff that they do. And I started to work with them for quite a few years. Mm-hmm. And then I started working with Women in Science and Engineering at the Mount.
And so this is interacting with high school age.
Junior high school. Junior high school age students. So it's to get Black African Nova Scotian students in science. That's what IMATEP does, get them interested in STEM, and then Women in Science and Engineering, they do it from female point of view.
In terms of other people running their labs, what do you think is the simplest possible things that, you know, they can do to encourage women, encourage Black people into science?
I think one thing is to be open and welcoming, and to create an environment where people feel comfortable. Right? Because if I walk into a lab and comments are made and, you know, you get those little microaggressions that the supervisor is not aware of or could be doing themselves, you know, no one wants to be in that. So it's about creating the environment, because you can bring somebody in, but that's just the first step. So that it's important that once they get there, you don't just bring them in and leave them. You support them and you provide the environment that they can excel in. Right. So you have to have a constant support to get them through. Right. And the other thing, too, is you have to be a little bit more open with the people who you're taking into your lab. You also always have to think diversity. You have to say, OK, well, maybe this person doesn't have the excellent grades, but they can excel at this. So give them a chance to come in.
So do you think considering those approaches at the very beginning is an important part of running a successful lab?
Yes, you have to make a conscious decision to step out and do it. And do it for the right reasons, not do it because NSERC is asking you
to. Sure, of course. I think it's on society's mind right now, right? I mean, so we have this Black Lives Matter movement, and obviously there's a very small portion of that which concerns Black people in science.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we have a huge push for women in STEM, I feel, and a huge push for gender equality and
for gender equality
in Canada.
For minorities in science.
How do those struggles intersect?
They're the same, and at the same time, they're different. In my experience, really, it's hard to be taken seriously at certain points, and that's one of the reasons I worked really hard to make sure that I do good science. My thought is if my science is good, right, then you can't question whether or not I'm good at what I do. So that's the added approach that I take. I've gotten it from both ends. You're downplayed and as a woman. Saying your research is cute, or that's nice, or, you know. And then as a Black person, you're then outright ignored, right? Then you go to the conferences, and then you don't get the time of day because, you know, for whatever reason. So then you have to work doubly hard to carve out what it is that you need to do, right? And then you grow a very thick skin and you figure out that. And this is one of the reasons, too, why I'm doing this, because I'm a little apprehensive to start with at first. But a student said to me, it's important that I see you. And it was important for me to see other women doing it, even though they weren't Black. So I'm doing this because I'm thinking it's important for others to see me too. And then they will do it.
It's definitely an inspiring story, being Black, being a woman, being an immigrant. and having the success you've had. It's pretty amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But I have to say, it's the people around me that really played a huge, huge part. Yeah, especially my mother.
Thank you so much for coming in today. It's been really an interesting conversation. In our next episode, I'll be the one sitting in the hot seat. Dal student Gracious Kasheke will be interviewing me, and this will be our last episode of our third season. Don't miss it. If you're enjoying the Sciographies podcast, hit subscribe, give us a rating. I'm your host, David Barkley. Thanks for listening.
Sciographies is brought to you by Dalhousie University's Faculty of Science and CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Our producer is Nicole Killowy. You can learn more about Sciographies at dal.ca/sciographies.